This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. You know all that fun that gets made of Infrastructure Week? They are really happy to have that infrastructure right now down in Louisiana. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday today, the 30th of August. Good as always to have you along, everybody. In the aftermath of Hurricane Ida down on the Gulf Coast, more than a million people are without power and are probably going to be that way for a while. Communications networks are down. Officials are telling people it's too dangerous to be moving around or to come back if they evacuated. But there are a lot of ways this whole thing could have been worse. So Marketplace's Kimberly Adams gets us going with the return on investment in all that infrastructure that seems to have held back the worst of this storm.
We're still waiting to learn the full scope of damage from Hurricane Ida, but said Louisiana Governor John Bel Edwards at a White House meeting today, there is some good news.
All of our levee systems, particularly our federal levee systems and hurricane risk reduction systems, performed magnificently.
It's a system that cost more than $14 billion, the response to the 2005 devastation from Hurricane Katrina.
What happened during Katrina was that the levee walls collapsed in more than 50 places, and water just poured in from the lake and from canals that surround the city.
Andy Horowitz teaches at Tulane University in New Orleans and wrote a book on Katrina. He evacuated to Birmingham, Alabama with his family on Friday.
The new system is built to be much more resilient and robust so that even if water comes over the top of one of the flood walls or one of the levees, the walls themselves won't fall down.
But some parts of the new system are already in need of repair, according to the Army Corps of Engineers, and holding back the water isn't the only infrastructure need for New Orleans and the surrounding areas.
Power outages and limited phone service are actually hindering rescue and hindering relief.
Jacob Remus teaches disaster studies at New York University, and he points out that with more severe storms likely to accompany global warming,
it shows how those things are actually really serious questions that we need to include under this rubric of infrastructure.
And with the infrastructure bill working its way through Congress now, Hurricane Ida provides a real-life example of the need for answers to those questions. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, oil was up just a little bit, but gas rose 1.5%, what with all the refinery capacity on the Gulf Coast out of commission for the next couple of days anyway. In equities, a couple of more record highs, which might not, as you are going to hear in about 30, maybe 45 seconds, might not be such a good thing. We'll have the details on the rest of it when we do the numbers. We talked a bit on Friday about Fed Chair Jay Powell's big speech at Jackson Hole and where he thinks inflation stands and what the central bank's got planned for its big bond buying program. We're going to spend some time today on what Powell said with Mohamed El-Erian. He's the president of Queens College, Cambridge, also the chief economic advisor at Allianz. And for the past couple of months, He's been a critic of the central bank's approach to this economic moment. Dr. Ellerian, welcome back to the program, sir.
Wonderful to be with you. Thank you.
We talked in June, and you made your case that the Federal Reserve was making a policy mistake in providing so much support to the economy for so long. Here we are, 6 weeks, 2 months later. The economy has obviously changed with the Delta variant. Chair Powell made the big speech on Friday. Are you more or less concerned than you were 8 weeks ago?
I am as concerned, not because I don't think the economy needs help, but I think monetary policy is the wrong tool. And other Federal officials have come out and said explicitly it is not clear that the current policy approach is actually helping the economy.
Yeah, what do you make, not to get into the Kremlinology of the Federal Reserve, but a number of senior Federal Reserve regional presidents have come out and said, you know what, it's time to start cutting back on this support sooner or later. What do you make of that?
Yeah, we're seeing the center of gravity within the FOMC, which is the Federal Reserve Policymaking Committee, shift towards let's ease off this incredible stimulus that was introduced in the midst of the COVID emergency. Now, why are they shifting? A few reasons. One is they're getting evidence that the inflation that we are all experiencing is likely to be more persistent and higher than they thought. Secondly, there's very little evidence that suggests that this is helping the economy. And thirdly, it continues to decouple asset prices, markets, from the real economy, which makes inequality worse and increases the risk of financial instability.
What do you suppose you and some of those regional Fed presidents are looking at that either Chair Powell isn't seeing or is seeing and choosing to stay the course anyway?
Well, clearly Chair Powell has evolved because he came out on Friday and said that lots of ground has been covered to reach the maximum employment objective and that the inflation objective has been met. So clearly he sees things evolving. I think what's different is how you see the balance of risk. I can't speak for others, but I can tell you I see it as two-sided, that there's a risk that we may end up doing more harm than good, whereas the chair is still seeing it more as one-sided. So I think it's a balance of risk argument rather than what's actually happening on the ground, because what's happening on the ground is very clear. We have higher and more persistent inflation, and we've created 1.9 million jobs in just 2 months.
And this balance is that Powell thinks the risks are going to fade and you think they're going to continue and accelerate, perhaps?
He believes strongly that inflation is transitory, meaning it is both temporary and reversible. I am saying, you know what, we have to be more humble about this inflation dynamic. There's a likelihood that inflation will be more persistent. That's number one. And second, his read of history suggests to him that it's better to make the mistake of underreacting to inflation than overreacting. Mm-hmm. Whereas my read of history is let's look at both these likely mistakes and make sure that we strike the right balance.
You wrote in a Bloomberg piece out today, I think, about Chair Powell working toward or trying to wordsmith his way, I suppose, to constructive ambiguity. And that is to say, if I can interpret, have it a little bit both ways?
Correct. So he acknowledged what other people have been seeing, but then he packaged it in a very dovish packaging. And that's why the markets got all excited and we got yet another record high. Mm-hmm. So clearly the financial markets love this liquidity paradigm. But Chair Powell packaged it by saying, even though these things are happening, he said two things. One is there's still ground to cover. And two, only time will tell whether the 2% inflation will be sustainable. This is basically giving himself optionality. He is basically trying to have constructive ambiguity. However, the market at some point is going to insist on clarity.
All right. Well, since Chair Powell, despite our repeated invitations, has not yet decided to come back on the program, and I do have you here, let me try to nail you down on timing. How long do you think it will take before we have a sense of who's right?
So I think towards the end of the year, we're going to get the answer to one important question. Is inflation higher and more persistent than the Fed expects? The Fed is looking for it to start coming back down and have clear evidence that we will be within near 2% next year. On the employment front, it's trickier. this labor market is behaving in a rather strange way. We know that we've got 800,000 jobs to make up from before the pandemic, but we also know that there's a record level of vacancies, 10 million. So something is not quite working in the labor market. That, I think, is going to take a little bit longer to sort out.
Mohammed Alarian, he is chief economic advisor at Allianz, also in his spare time, I suppose, the president of Queen's College, Cambridge. Dr. Alarian, thanks for your time, sir. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
This is a big week for housing data. The National Association of Realtors said today pending sales of existing homes fell last month, almost 2% from June. It is the second month of declines. We're going to get the benchmark Case-Shiller Index tomorrow. That is home prices. But a story now about the stuff that we put in our houses. The biggest furniture chain in the world, that would be IKEA, is getting into the buyback and resale business as a way to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Starting today, at one store in suburban Philadelphia, the company is going to pilot a program to buy back its used furniture in exchange for store credit. Part of a plan, the company says, to keep all those Billy bookcases and Malm bed frames from landing in the landfill. Marketplace's Amy Scott reports.
There's already a huge market for used IKEA furniture. A quick search of Craigslist DC netted 636 items, including an Ektorp sectional for $200. But what about what doesn't find a home?
Around 9 million tons of furniture are thrown out every year in landfills.
Jonathan Matuszewski is a home furnishings analyst at Jefferies.
You really just need to walk, you know, Midtown Manhattan to be able to see that in terms of folks moving in and out.
Resale has taken off in the apparel industry with retailers like Nordstrom and Macy's and online sites ThredUp and The RealReal. Tansy Whalen directs NYU Stern's Center for Sustainable Business. She says IKEA faces a big challenge in meeting its goal of zero waste by 2030. It's not exactly known for durability.
They may start to design the product a little differently, right? If they find that there's a second life and more money to be made on it lasting a little bit longer.
Other companies have a different take on sustainability. Michael Barlow is CEO of Furnish, a furniture rental startup. His company went through IKEA's corporate accelerator, so he's diplomatic.
We're not putting cheap veneers out there with customers in the first place, because we need to refurbish those to a like-new state and get them into a second, a third, a fourth home.
And that doesn't come at Billy bookcase prices. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
So we've got a bunch of shows that are podcast only. You know that, right? Million Bazillion, This Is Uncomfortable, The Uncertain Hour. Also, you can get, if you need to, if you miss us on your local public radio station, you can get this program and David's program in the morning and Molly's program on tech. Oh, and the thing Molly and I do as well, Make Me Smart. You can get it all on a podcast. Check it out. Coming up,
there's weekends that you have to sacrifice.
I mean, do I really? First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's down 55 today. The double nickel, 0.1%, 35,399. The NASDAQ gained 136 points, about 0.9%, 15,265. The S&P 500, 19 points to the good, about 0.4%, 45.28. We heard from Kimberly about whether the infrastructure investment in New Orleans, that's levees and flood control, made a difference given Hurricane Ida. So, some of those kinds of stocks today. Eagle Materials was flat. Oil and gas company Kinder Morgan down about 1.5%. Jacobs Engineering Group down 0.4%. Amy was telling us just now about IKEA's plans to resell its own gently used furniture. Looking at some cheap and chic competitors. Wayfair gained 0.2%. Overstock.com lost about 0.8% today. Target basically flat, up less than 0.1%. Bond prices, well, they rose. Thank you so much for asking. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note down to 1.27%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail. Or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. On the podcast How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failure, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more business content like this, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. If you've been watching cable news even a little bit the past couple of weeks, you might have spotted a whole lot of Toyotas in videos coming out of Afghanistan. Thanks in part to their reputation for durability, Toyotas have been the vehicles of choice for the Taliban and other groups for decades now, which, looking at the world the way that we do around here, had us pondering what the events in Afghanistan might mean for the Toyota brand. Utpal Dholakia is a professor of marketing at Rice University. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
So if I'm a brand manager at Toyota and I see all these pictures on cable news of Taliban running around in my cars and Jeeps, how worried am I?
Not much. So this issue with Taliban and Toyota has been around for 20 years. And in all this time, Toyota has done really well, despite its connection with the Taliban, the ISIS, and all kinds of terror groups.
Still, though, is this one of those, you know, the only bad publicity is no publicity? Is that where we are?
So let's talk a little bit about negative product placement, right? This is a situation when the brand really has no control over who uses it and how they use it. And Toyota is a pretty rich brand with a lot of positive associations and a huge base of loyal customers. So in some sense, it is insulated from some negative publicity over which it has no control.
Are there other examples? I mean, Toyota is obviously, you know, top of mind because of the Taliban, but there have to be others out there.
Yes. For example, Osama bin Laden had a great fondness for Coke, you know, Coca-Cola.
Huh.
And then there was this really interesting story of this Norwegian mass murderer who preferred to wear Lacoste shirts he was in the courtroom, you know. So the list goes on and on.
Is there a tipping point where consumers actually do click in and say, you know what, I saw XYZ, so I'm not going to buy that product?
The issue is of the brand kind of controlling the action. One example is Gab, and then another one is Parler. Both these social media platforms were kind of started with the idea of freedom of speech and allowing people to say whatever they wanted to say, you know? And then these platforms come to be associated with things like conspiracy theories and insurrections and things like this, you know? And this is where you can argue that the brand is kind of much more closely associated with things that it can control, you know?
Yeah. So, all right. So just back to our starting example with Toyota, just as one last question here. I mean, so Toyota took some steps to try to make sure that new vehicles were not getting into Taliban's hands, right? Do companies have a responsibility to be proactive when they see this stuff?
They have responsibility to be proactive for sure, but there's only so much they can do, you know? So a lot of the actions that Toyota has taken because of its association with the Taliban is to do things like prevent the sale of new trucks for 1 year after someone buys it in Japan. Mm-hmm. To my mind, at least, this is more symbolic than substantial. You know, it creates this image that Toyota is doing something about it. But the question is, how much can a brand really do?
Right. And fundamentally, bad actors, whether it's the Taliban or anybody else, they're going to do what they're going to do.
Exactly. So they try to do small things which are clearly communicating where they stand.
Right. Right. Did Coca-Cola or Lacoste or any of those that are associated with some of the more unsavory characters in recent history, did they suffer at all from those associations?
Not in any measurable way. So again, Lacoste did something just like Toyota, which is they approached the police and the court authorities to try to get this masculine to stop wearing their brand. But the effects are negligible. You know, there is something called as brand insulation, which is the fact that customers, especially loyal customers, kind of draw upon the goodwill that the brand has created for them. And kind of when adverse events happen like this, customers are willing to give brands a benefit of the doubt.
Right. Utpal Dulaki, he's a professor of marketing at Rice University. Thanks for your time, sir. I appreciate it.
It was a pleasure talking with you, Kai. Thank you.
If you've noticed, but the service economy has been finding new market share in retail stores. That is, places where people go to buy stuff. Goods is what economists call that. Most recently, it's been vaccination services for the coronavirus. For some years now, of course, it's been the flu shot. Possibly the next big thing, mental health services. CVS is expanding a pilot program that started in 2020, offering in-person counseling at some of their clinics. Walmart and Walgreens are doing something similar as well. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab has that one.
When it comes to most health services, access and convenience are big factors. Cara McNulty is president of CVS Health Aetna.
And so we're meeting people where they're at.
And where they're at may not be too far from a CVS. There are nearly 10,000 in the U.S., and more than 1,000 of them have walk-in healthcare clinics. CVS currently has mental health professionals in 34 of those.
Maybe you're being seen for an ear infection, and you started talking about some other issues, our nurse practitioner could suggest you see the therapist.
One piece of accessibility this may not help with is cost. CVS says for the insured, an initial assessment is, on average, $130 and $60 for half-hour sessions. Vail Wright at the American Psychological Association says that's on par with the median price for mental health care. But she does think the service could lessen the stigma of seeking help and the burden of finding it.
Because I do think one of the biggest hurdles is not even knowing where to start.
The start is where Wright sees most use for this type of service. CVS says it works with local providers to recommend patients for ongoing treatment or more serious mental health issues. But what's in it for CVS? Mickey Chadha, an analyst at Moody's, says pharmacies want to establish a more personal relationship with the customer.
Filling a prescription is a very transactional approach. Now you're engaging with the person behind the counter.
Pharmacies want you to pick them because they provide you with specific personalized health services, not just because they're closest to your home or work. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
The thing about the pandemic, and this isn't news by any means, is that it's given a lot of people cause to reconsider some things. Personally, sure, but also professionally. Are you happy in what you do? Or are you just paying the bills? Are you doing a job, or do you have a calling? With that, here's today's installment of our series, My Economy.
My name is Jordan Leckband. I am the K-5 general music teacher at Windsor Elementary School in Des Moines, Iowa. My previous job was teaching middle school and high school choir in Western Iowa. And when we moved to Des Moines in August of 2019, my commute was moved to about an hour each way. And I told my wife, I will do this commute for a year and then we'll see where we are. But the pandemic kind of accelerated our situation. As with so many people during the pandemic, I think it gave us all some time to reassess our priorities. And that was very much the case with me. I was hoping to be the hotshot choir teacher, teaching at a high school, going to competitions. And then reality sat in. There's a lot of late nights. There's weekends that you have to sacrifice. And I felt like my life was out of balance. My life was ready to go into a different situation. And that situation happened to be elementary music. In June of 2020, I saw on the job board that there was a job for an elementary school that is about 2 minutes away from my house with stoplights. So I applied, and the rest is history. All that matters is your connection with the students. I am absolutely thrilled with where I am right now. If you would have told me when I was in college that I was going to be teaching elementary general music, I would have laughed in your face. But now I realize that it is really what I want to do, teaching the basics to young students. I love it, and I don't want to be anywhere else.
Jordan Leckband, teaching elementary music in Des Moines, Iowa. We cannot do what we do in this series without your stories. So send them to us, would you, at marketplace.org/myeconomy. This final note on the way out today, it is literally all over for the United States in Afghanistan. The following NOTAM, that's Notice to Airmen, it's a notification system for hazards and information for air crews. The following NOTAM was filed today by the DOD this afternoon, U.S. time, middle of the night in Kabul. Here's what it says. Effective immediately, Hamid Karzai International Airport is uncontrolled. No air traffic control or airport services are available. Aircraft operating into or out of or through Kabul Flight Identification Region and landing at Hamid Karzai should use extreme caution. The Pentagon confirmed it this afternoon. It is all over. Okay, we're done. I talked too much. No moment of economic context today. Our daily production team is Anais Amin, Andy Corbin, Richard Cunningham, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, Daisy Palacios, and Minju Park. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.